Welcome to Kingdom Conversations. This is Curtis. This week, we will be continuing our discussion on addiction with our special guest, Christy. If you missed last week's episode, I highly recommend you download Addiction Part 1 and give that a listen, as we will be picking up this week exactly where we stopped last week.
When you talked about loving, you know, giving, you know, caring for yourself and loving yourself, remind me of scripture passage. It talks about, you know, loving your neighbor as you love yourself. And oftentimes the focus there always goes to the loving your neighbor part, and it gets de-emphasized, the fact of being able to love yourself. If you don't love yourself in a good way, you won't be able to love anyone. Or otherwise they'll say, you know, I've seen your love, keep it far from me, kind of thing. But so there is a value, a great value I see too, in an agreement and talking about scripture of, you know, you need to have a healthy love for yourself so you can be a healthy person. Otherwise, what good can you offer anyway?
Kind True. Of a, and I think that I have a manager. She's recently resigned. Unfortunately, we're going to miss her. But she did some wonderful team building for us and created a family-like, a genuinely family-like work atmosphere for us. But she said that, you know, in a caring culture, it starts with yourself, and you have to be able to be kind to yourself first to be able to really be kind to others. So like that just kind of emphasizes that.
Yeah.
In the medical field, that's so hard. And it's funny, we could cut this out if it's inappropriate, but I'm blank stares.
Oh, dear God.
No, I'm serious. In the medical field, you can put others above yourself so much that I will sometimes have to contemplate what is going to be the right thing to either continue with my patients or go to the restroom. And I'm saying, like, it gets that bad. It gets that bad. There are nurses that don't even, there's nurses that will not use the restroom for 8 to 10 hours because they're just giving. And I'm saying it's hard in the medical field. I'm in dentistry. It's not quite the same, but we're still seeing patients. I'm still, you know, I'm still seeing people that are in pain or going through some sort of, you know, medical crisis. And it's hard because in the medical field, as a nurse, as a dental assistant, there's so much giving to do that sometimes you have to really stop and say, I need to eat right now. I need to take care of myself, because often people in medical professions don't take care of their immediate physical needs.
Well, and that goes back to one-way relationships that I was reading about with, I read a book. I'm sorry, I'm going to fumble on this, but it's called I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's a book about depression, and the author struggled with depression many, many years. And he actually did research to find out that there is actually no hard evidence that SSRIs actually treat depression. It's very much a pharmaceutical industry. But what he talked about is that even as a patient, he recognized that the relationship between a patient and a nurse is a one-way relationship. The nurse can help him, but he can't do anything. He could see that she might be, you know, overtasked, and he's not allowed to get out of bed without her assistance. You know, like he was able to recognize like that imbalance that creates this one-way relationship culture in so many different aspects.
Yeah.
And
you said that SSRIs,
what
can you define that for our listeners?
SSRIs, a serotonin reuptake inhibitors that treat antidepressants. And I wanted to give you the name of the book, but there's a great interview I watched on YouTube that he did, and he spent a journey. He actually struggled with addiction, and he was so ashamed to really address it and deal with it and the emotional pain it brought to him, that he actually ended up writing the book about depression. No, I'm sorry. He had such bad depression and developed addiction that when he was trying to write about depression it took him 10 years to write the book, but he actually ended up writing a book on addiction first because it was easier for him to talk about addiction than it was for him to talk about his feelings. And he met with some of the most amazing experts in the world on so many different things, like people who work with dolphins and, you know, to really understand depression. He feels that it's what it's the community of bringing people together that you find true healing. Like he wrote about this one guy, some country he went to. He said he wanted to talk about depressants. He said, well, we have antidepressants here. We call it a cow. When someone's depressed, we give them a cow. And now they have all these things they have to do to take care of this cow. And by taking care of this cow and doing all these activities, the person would actually recover from this interaction with something else. So it was just, I'm not doing any justice to this book, but it was a different eye-opening experience about how, it really kind of highlighted places like the United States. We're a very individualistic society, and we're expected to be, you know, on our own and self-sufficient, and everything's personal and private. And, you know, and in Eastern cultures, when depression exists, it's not an individual, it's a community experience. If one person is affected, the entire family or the entire community experiences it together. And so they react differently. That it's not that individual's problem, it's everyone's problem. Well, here, if you're depressed, it's your problem.
Suck it up.
So it's just different. It's the different approaches. And it was eye-opening to me. And, you know, I think that I don't know why I can't think of the name of the book. Oh, it's called
Google. It's worse the older you get, by the way. Just something to look forward to.
I do apologize that I'm talking about something without remembering the name, because it's a great book. It's called Lost Connections. And really about how people have become so disconnected. He talks about being disconnected because of our phones, being disconnected because of so many different things. And I like how he talks about this one village where in Germany, this elderly woman hangs a sign outside of her apartment and says that she's going to kill herself because she can't. She's being evicted and she has nowhere to go, so she's going to kill herself. And somebody, I think he walked by and said, well, why? Why are you going to do this? She's like, I have nowhere to go. He's like, well, that doesn't seem right. She's 80 years old in a wheelchair. They're going to kick you out on the street. And so all these people kind of started, you know, all these people living in these walls, they were all experiencing the same thing, but nobody knew that their neighbor was going through the same thing. And they somehow got to know each other as a community and basically rallied against this situation and created, like, helped basically bring laws so you can't like throw people out on the street, and became this community of people who said, you know, we're not going to allow this. You need to have rent control. You need to be able to stop raising the rent so that people have, you know, ridiculous amounts of money to pay. They can't afford to live here. You know, you're basically destroying this community. And so this community kind of stuck together and fought against it. And it was kind of like they saw that as a success story and proof that it's really about people being connected to kind of overcome some of these situations. And I kind of saw that as a similar thing with addiction. Like, so many people feel like it's their problem and they don't want to inflict it on other people. But it actually affects everybody, you know. So, you know, when someone decides to recover, it has it can have a positive ripple effect on the people around them too. And so
absolutely,
I think, you know, it's not something you really want to have happen to anyone, but I think when you discover that you want to face it and overcome it, it can become a very enlightening and rewarding experience to go, wow, I had no idea that thing that I went through at 5 and, you know, seeing my parents, you know, give the shirt off their back would play a role in my situation today. Or, you know, I think it brings people together. So I'm like really happy to be able to share that story. Hopefully it'll, you know, inspire someone to make a difference in their own life somehow.
For somebody else that's listening that is struggling with codependency, do you have any piece of advice that you could get them to, if they're haven't sought help yet but are just, you know, now discovering that they're codependent, you have any advice for them?
Gosh, you know, listen to yourself. I think it's easy to want everyone else's opinion to weigh in on everything. I think we do that by putting, you know, blast things on Facebook, and we want everyone to either like our post or approve of what we say, or, you know, we find out that people don't like what we say and it bothers us. And I think try to drown out what everybody else is saying and listen to yourself. And just because other people don't agree with you or like what you want to do, that's okay. And it's sometimes really hard to go against what you know want. You know, I think people who are codependent are often looking for other people's approval. Mm-hmm. And I think no one's approval matters more than your own to yourself. And make sure that, because at the end of the day, you're the one who lives with your decisions and it's your life. So, you know, make sure that, you know, you realize that this is it and you get to do with what you want with it. So don't give it away to other people.
Where are you now? How are you doing with your addiction?
I think it's,
I mean, once an addict, always an addict.
Yeah, I guess I would say I'm in a good place. I don't feel like it has a control over me, mostly probably because I take a medication called naltrexone that controls my desires to want to drink. So I don't feel like it's causing me any, like, physical suffering. I think it's more living with the fact that that's only part of it. I can remove that aspect of it, but I still have to deal with all the behavioral things that led me there. And those behavioral things are the things that are, that's the hard part. It's easy to stop drinking because that's just like a vehicle for it. But like, what are the behaviors? So I think I'm still constantly having to remember to think about myself and self-care. So right now I would say, you know, I'm going to be running a half marathon. So for me, not having done something like that in 10 years, it feels like I'm reconnecting with a part of my life that's probably been kind of dormant. So I'm trying to revive aspects of my persona, things that I think got me through a rather a childhood with a lot of adversity. I think running was one of those things that got me through a lot. It helped me travel, see things. It gave me opportunities that I probably otherwise wouldn't have had. So it's something that I never would want to just walk away from and stop doing. And I think it's hard. It's something that became slowly less and less an aspect of my life. So I think right now I'm going back to nurturing those aspects of my person, my persona. And it's still something that, you know, I probably will struggle with, but I know that and I work on it. And I think it's at this point something, I think the more you share with other people, it keeps you honest about it, you know. And I think it's easier to share your stories and not want to repeat them when you tell people about it.
How about in your codependent relationships? Do you have any ways to safeguard yourself from re-entering such relationships?
I don't know. I mean, like, for example, that story I told you about trying to help that person at the resort, it probably sounds cruel, but I really didn't want to, but I still put myself out there. And I don't know, honestly, how often I'm going to struggle with that, but it's something that I don't, I know if I'm going to drink alcohol, it's going to be a lot harder for me to recognize and to avoid. So I think that avoiding alcohol is a good place to start, because you're in control. When you're, when, you know, if you're drinking alcohol, you're not in control, really, as in control. You're more likely to be like, oh, hey, I'm just going to throw my judgment aside for this moment, for whatever reason, you know. And then I think that's a big aspect of it. So that, I think that's where the codependency and the addiction go hand in hand. It's hard to have control and sound judgment and recognize a situation where you are putting yourself at risk as a codependent if you're drinking alcohol, because you're gonna completely what is that word they say? You're uninhibited. Mm-hmm. Your guard is down. You're just really not as aware of what's going on. And so I think that's, for me, I would say I'm somebody who clearly did not really recognize what a codependent they were. I knew I was being told I was one, but it took me a long time to understand that. So I would say I'm still learning. Learning that I don't have to be in a relationship, because I am in one with myself. And I think that's the thing that I recognize, that I feel like there's so many people around me that are probably in the same thing. They just don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I try to just take a step back and not volunteer to join in on other people's situations if I can. Like, you know, like, let's say I'm out in public and you see well, for example, the flight here, I was sitting next to a couple, and it was a very quiet flight most of the flight. They had their headphones on. They were watching a movie, and they each had four drinks. And by the end of the flight, they were in an argument over something like, did you tell someone that we were going to this event? No, I didn't tell them. Well, that's not what they said. And I was sitting there thinking, had I had a drink, I probably would have joined in on the conversation that I wasn't invited in on, just because the arguing was disturbing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to kind of, I and the other people around them were subjected to that. And I think that's where, I think being a codependent, you feel like, oh, I want to like fix this problem. I want to tell them it's really not a big deal. You should probably just go and have a good time on your trip. Well, it was really none of my business, so I just stayed out of it. So I think it's hard for me to still kind of be able to recognize where, as in being a nurse, you have to recognize the things you can affect, the things that you're responsible for, and the things that you're not. And as someone on vacation, I'm really not responsible for other people's arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's something I'm still on a daily basis trying to work on. And I do have daily meditations that I really love to read and learn from that usually are telling me it's okay to have a good day. And that's something that codependents struggle with. There's usually something that happens during the day where you feel like, oh my gosh, this happened to me. I was at the grocery store and someone bumped into my car. And you want to make that the center of your day, like talk about how, what an injustice that happened.
Mm.
So I think I'm working on trying to focus on the positives and less on the negatives.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sally, do you have anything you want to ask? You've been very quiet.
I know, because we're sharing a microphone, so it gets hard. You can't just chime in. No, I mean, I think it's been great just to hear everything. I know one thing we were talking a little bit in the car about, and we like to talk on this podcast too, is about just how our faith influences, you know, things we're going through. And I know we were sharing a little bit about how, you know, your relationship with God is personal, and it's not about the religion side or going to church, mm-hmm. but you felt like that was also maybe something like about your persona, or at least something about your upbringing.
Oh, yeah.
So I wondered if you could share about how you, like, if that helped you, or how you drew upon your faith, or how that's influenced things.
I don't know if you guys know who the singer is, Sam Smith, but he sings a song called "Everyone Prays in the or Pray," and one of the lines in it is "Everyone prays in the end." And I remember, like, through some of the worst things I was going through, I remember that song was like, you know, "Everyone prays in the end." I was just imagining, like, some of the things, like, I think when you're really hitting rock bottom, you are praying. Mm-hmm. I think people really do say, oh my God, like, God, help me get out of the situation. And I think that exists for a reason, because I do think, at least I have faith in God, and I always asked God, you know, to help me. And what I was telling Sally was that I wonder what decisions I would have made if I didn't have faith in God. I do believe that the decisions I made to seek help or admit to myself that this was wrong for me and that I needed to change, I think those did come from those core values that I had, my upbringing. And I think my faith in God is one of the reasons why I was able to persevere and know that I could get through this and believe I could get through this. And I think that when I meet other people who are struggling or think very poorly of themselves, I think, gosh, you know, if you only knew that there's so many other people who've been there. And I don't know, I always felt like, you know, God would say that he's not going to judge me. And if admitting to myself is the same as admitting to him, then I'm making that choice and asking for his help. And I think that's what it comes down to, is knowing you can't do it on your own. And I really don't think I could have done this without my faith in God to turn, you know, to admit where I was at. Because I think you can't escape yourself. And to me, that's the same as having God right there. Like, you know, you can't escape yourself. So he's like, you're like, if I'm going to get out of this, God, please help me. Yeah. So that's how my relationship with God is. It just feels like you can only avoid yourself so long before you have to confront it. And hopefully other people will find that strength within and with God to ask for help.
Yeah.
For me, in my faith journey with addiction, I always felt judged, you know, like I've always felt like I'm a screw up because of, I'm weak. I don't have what it takes. But F it. I'm going to just have a good time then, because I know I'm bollocks. So I got to a place in my relationship with God where it wasn't so much that, like, judgment wasn't even on God's lips. It was about, hey man, it's okay. You know, just, I love you and we can get through this. You know, you're not alone in this. You're not as lost as you think you are in your mess. You know, I'd go through a lot of, replacing addictions with other addictions and different, you know, alcohol, drugs, go back and forth, find new drugs. So it was today it is finding, like, that center of self and being okay with yourself. And I think that's something you were talking about that I don't have yet. Like, even, you know, been a Christian, gone to Bible college, been a pastor, like, I still have stuff inside me that's like, I'm not okay with myself and don't necessarily like myself that much in certain aspects of my life and the way I think. So it's still a battle, you know? But even though I'm struggling with that, I still hear a loving voice not judging me and just loving me.
You made me remember some stuff. Like, I used to try to, like, go without drinking, and then I couldn't I couldn't make it past day 7. And I would just say, magic, oh, screw
number.
It. You know
magic
what? I already,
number.
And I would drink, and I'm like, what difference? I'm like, one glass. I'm like, well, what difference does it make? I'm just going to drink the whole bottle. I already yeah. drank a glass. And I would yep. justify that. And that's just crazy. Be like, well, what difference does it make? I already failed.
Mm-hmm.
And you just tell yourself that there's really no point in trying because you already failed. Yeah. And so I think that's the trap. That's the addiction.
Mm-hmm. And I still get that with cheesecake.
Now you've gone to Medellin, man.
Yeah.
Now you've gone to Medellin.
Well.
So crazy.
I mean, there's so many different ways to look at it. Like some people will say it's a spiritual thing or this or that. And then I love how I have, you know, one of the, I'm sure you've heard this before, but one of the first things that said to me, like, I said, I can't go past day 7. I can't. He's like, well, just try holding your breath. How long can you go without oxygen? You can't, you know, and I'm talking about like the reward center in the brain and like the whole, it's like, it's a primitive part of our brain that's so much more powerful than the part of us that makes the decision, you know, and that's mm-hmm. that's where, why I take the naltrexone, because it's really that pathway is being closed. So it's, you know, there are certain things that I'm sure if I wasn't taking the naltrexone, I would probably have, if I wasn't drinking alcohol, I'd probably be like getting myself caught up in some sort of emotional drama that would create, you know, this toxic situation in some way. If it's not alcohol, it's emotions. If it's this or that. And that's one of the things that this medication does, is it shuts down that center of the brain. Mm. And I can actually not engage in those cycles because my brain isn't going to get stimulated by it. So it's not like I'm doing this all on my own and with God only. I'm actually using medication, and it's very effective. And I think that's one of the things that I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't found someone who could have introduced me to the treatment. Mm. I will say that.
Yeah, I don't think God has any problems with medication. I really don't. I think that may have a stigma in the church sometimes, but it really shouldn't.
Paul told Timothy to take a little wine with his stomach because he's having some stomach problems. So wine, there's some things
Prozac,
that kind of work, you know, there.
Right,
but
it's the
I kind of, you know, I kind of think of, you know, medication. It's another form of support in a lot of cases. And my work as a chaplain, I work with folks, you know, my own background with addiction, but I work with addiction all the time. And one of the big things we're about is support, you know, investigating with people what their support is, both socially and what is their support spiritually. What do you got going in your life there that's kind of, and it's always one of the main issues that's going on. It's a lack of, you know, one of the constant trends is a lack of quality support.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say I got family and all that, but that doesn't necessarily qualify as quality support. And I just realized, you know, myself, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't have my lovely wife with me. I wouldn't be sober in my right mind. I would have died out there had it not been for my support I got from God and support I got from people. Of course, having to make some decisions along the way, cooperating with part of that process, but it all working together. And that's what made, you know, just hearing you tell your story, that's what made me being able to sit here a possibility, because mm-hmm. I was a reclusive alcoholic. You know, my alcoholism, it was, you know, alcohol, any addiction, it's a hard, also you call it a female in this case, it's a harsh mistress.
Mm.
My alcohol was a very harsh mistress to me. And, you know, you talked about the one-way relationship, but it's having some of those other healthy relationships where you can feel loved and supported and someone actually cares that you can share with and kind of get this stuff out and kind of let the skeletons out of my closet. You know, we had a saying in recovery that you're only as sick as your secrets. You know, being able to be transparent, and that requires some intimacy and relationship and trust.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that just kind of makes me reflect a bit on my own journey with recovery and what's made it possible to where that pull that I used to live with that would just like a tractor beam pulling me towards alcohol, just drawing me, that I can say that that monster is not with me anymore. It's because of the support and love I had from people in my relationship with God. So, you know, yeah.
Is it okay if I share something more to what you said?
Sure.
So, like, I would say things, the relationship I'm cultivating and building with myself about being okay with me, who I am, I would say that the person that wasn't okay with me cared so much about things like that. Now it's like I'm wondering, like, gosh, now that I'm becoming okay with myself, I'm like looking around and I'm just like, we are like being taken for a ride by so many commercial marketing situations. Like just my flight out here, I'm sitting at the airport and you know how they have, they call like the first class and then the special gold member and then all these different, we're like such a classist society. And I'm like, first of all, they're calling like all these people to board first. And all I see is a big mob of people. I'm like, how is that really a privilege? And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't even know what seating number I'm on, but I don't care. I'm not going to stand in a big mobby line because I have to somehow feel good about myself that I'm being called to be boarded before other people. And yeah. I think that's like one of the things that I like, I maybe it's also just maturity and getting older, but there's so many people that I think it's so important to them that they have to board the plane before other people, and for their own reasons, you know, it may not be for the reasons that I would have felt that way, but what would have motivated me that way is I actually would have believed I was somehow more entitled or deserved it more than other people. And I just think those are the kind of things that I think people who are struggling to feel good about themselves, it just preys on them. And I don't like that, you know, we actually encourage people to somehow get treated better because they have more money to pay to get on the plane first. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So I guess that's where I'm like, I would have been vulnerable to feeling like I was less than because I didn't want to pay the extra $300 to get on the plane before other people. Somehow I was not as good as those people in the past. Now I could care less. And I think that's where I feel like that stuff doesn't matter to me anymore. And now I'm kind of like stuck with my life the way it is going, gosh, do I really even want to work full time? I actually have a question, like, I have this fantasy in my head. I wish I could just quit my job.
That's not, everyone has that fantasy. Everyone has that fantasy.
Tiny house nation.
But being okay with not having all, like you don't have any time for yourself. I just want to like go and be doing something like gardening and making less money and being okay with less. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm finding it's changing me in a way. Like I want to have less because I don't think I'm getting anything out of having this full-time job and this big commute and this all this responsibility so that I really have this much time to spend with myself.
Luxury.
You're
apartment.
Not alone. A lot of us are having those conversations and realizations, actually.
Yeah. We're going to start a commune.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing. All focusing on the things that matter and getting rid of some of the things that don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, because just yesterday you were talking about how much time you spend in the car. Maybe when you're in the car, now you can listen to our podcast. But I actually found a lot of, like, I just loved podcasts since I've been traveling, but you're also traveling in, like you mentioned that it takes you an hour and a half to drive 13 miles.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And oh, I actually drive an hour, but it's like country roads and it's not so bad. But
can you get a bike? 13 miles on a road bike is a pretty easy ride. Sorry, I don't know why I thought of that. It is, but it
I've
is a pretty
about
easy
it,
ride.
But it's
yeah.
Yeah, it the
it's a good way to get killed.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unless you have an actual bike trail. We used to bike in Sacramento, but I mean, we were on
much
like an actual
environment.
An actual bike trail. We got on the road a bit to get back over to the other side of the bike trail, but I don't know. I'm just thinking 13 miles. I'm like, that's an easy, quick bike ride on a road bike. But then you have to deal with your stuff. And I don't know. Sorry, we cut that part out of the podcast.
But it's like a time vampire.
You
like
always say that we're going to cut it out.
And then you never do.
And then it's still there.
And that's
there.
When I'm like, when I say that, I think I'm like, I sound stupid right now. And Curtis will just cut that out if I say we should cut it out. And then I listen to the podcast and it's still in there. But yeah, whatever. Anyhow.
I always laugh during editing when I hear you say that. I'm like, yeah, I'm not
you're like
cut
you're
it out.
Totally leaving this one in
it's
there.
It's like a flag that it's not, that it's definitely going to stay.
I'm not self-conscious. Mm-hmm. It's all good. Just put it in there. But yeah, 13 mile. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. It's definitely a different way of life. And so I'm working on appreciating it. And...
Yeah,
you know, I think when we start to feel mortal and we're like, you know, we could find out we have aneurysms or something could happen. So now I'm at a place I'm trying to like go, you know, I'm here. I have this commute. I'm going to learn to love it somehow. Yeah. I'm going to learn to love it. Yeah. I'm going to figure out how, but it's hard.
Good goal.
Yeah.
Good goal.
Do you have any advice or any last words for you want to leave with somebody who might be just coming to terms with the fact that they have some codependency or addictions that they
Gosh.
Need to confront?
It gets better. And I would recommend reading a book, Codependent No More by Melody Beattie. Excellent book. And there's an app you can download, Learning to Let Go, Daily Meditations. And I think those are a good place to start.
Nice. Thank you, Christy, for being so open and sharing your story. And I think it's going to resonate with a lot of people. And
get a good night's sleep for your run tomorrow.
Yeah.
Both y'all.
Oh, it's Sunday.
Oh, Sunday. I'm sorry.
I'm making Christy get up to go do a run with some friends.
Gonna
at
need it.
6:30. So.
Gonna need it after that pizza.
Pizza and the time change.
Yeah.
It's like 6:30 is 3:30 in the morning for Christy.
All right, well, be sure to check out our website, right?
It's kingdom-conversations.com. And we're on Facebook, so you can find us there at Kingdom Conversations Podcast.
And we're on iTunes. And we're done. Thank you.
All right.
Yay, thank you, Christy.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.